offers a performance of the play Broadway, coupled with a musical review of Prohibition-era songs. For more information about the benefit and the final weeks of performances of My Three Angels, Last of the Red Hot Lovers, and Broadway, visit GranertCenter.com.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls.
I expect most people would agree that anyone who hurts another person should be held accountable under the law. However, our guest for this part of Focus 580, constitutional scholar Marcy Hamilton, says that in recent years, a number of religious groups have used the First Amendment to avoid prosecution for crimes, things like child abuse by clergy or medical neglect of children by faith healers. This morning in this part of Focus 580, Marcy Hamilton will talk with us about religion and the rule of law. It is the subject of her recent book, which is entitled God Versus the Gavel. It's published by the Cambridge University Press and is out just now. So if you're interested in the book, you can seek it out at a bookstore near you. Our guest is one of the nation's leading constitutional law scholars who publishes and lectures frequently on the topic of the relationship between church and state. She's professor of law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law of Yeshiva University. That's in New York. She's also been visiting scholar at Princeton Theological Seminary, visiting professor of law at New York University School of Law and Emory University School of Law. Professor Hamilton, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
I appreciate it. Just at the very top here, as people listen to what you have to say and we get into the subject, I do want to say and give you an opportunity to say right off that people should understand that this is not intended as an attack on religion. It is not.
Not at all. In fact, I'm actually a very religious person. My family's religious. My husband's Catholic. I'm Presbyterian. It's got nothing to do with religion bashing, but I do think that there's a way that American society has ordered itself, and it's good for everybody. And when religious entities hurt other people, they have to be held accountable.
You explain that you perhaps the reason that you were drawn into this issue, although this field is your field, but it specifically had to do with your involvement in a case that went to the Supreme Court involving the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in which you argued. In fact, you argued that it was unconstitutional, and the court found in your favor. Perhaps that is the place to start. We could talk a little bit about your entry into this subject.
Well, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which ends up being called RFRA, was a law that was passed by Congress in 93, and it basically said, with respect to every law in the country, whether it was federal or county or state, every law in the country could not be applied to someone who was religious unless it was absolutely necessary. And so it opened a lot of doors for religious individuals to get outside the law that, of course, were not open to anyone else. I was asked to come into the case because I do a lot of work on federalism, and there was a strong argument that the federal government couldn't do this to the states. They couldn't disable the state law in this way. And we did win. But with respect to the book, what's most interesting about the case is that I found myself, despite being religious, I found myself on the other side of virtually every organized religion in the country. And I'll never forget the day that 32 amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, were dropped off at my front door, and I started going through them, and they were every major faith in the country. And here I was. Being against them for a moment made me pause, but then I knew that the principle was right, and as a result, I was introduced to all of these entities in our society. They actually lobby against religion. Who would have known it? Their children group, many children's groups, and local governments and states, all sorts of prison authorities. I mean, all sorts of entities that I normally would have had no contact with, I ended up meeting them all at once as part of that litigation.
Mm-hmm. I guess I have a hard time on the one hand, I suppose I understand the idea that the Constitution says that you can't pass a law that will inhibit someone's free expression of their religion. On the other hand, I don't see how it is that you can make the argument that that merely being a member of a religious organization means that you would be exempt from laws that cover everybody else.
Well, I completely agree, but I'm definitely in the minority in the legal academy. The vast majority of scholars, at least since the 60s, when Justice Brennan introduced this concept, believe that you ought to give the benefit of the doubt to the religious entity, and if there's a fight between the law and that religious conduct, in general, they're willing to say, well, the law has to give way. In my experience, now that I know what I do, it's the wrong balance.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to explain why it is that the court started thinking that way?
Well, I think what happened is in the 60s, we were in the heyday of improving civil rights for African Americans and others, and it was a time when it looked like if you increase someone's rights, it has to be a good thing. But what was happening in that context was we were increasing rights to bring them to equality with everybody else. But what happened when we increased religious entities' rights, in the first case was Sherbert v. Verner, and Justice Brennan introduced this new idea, when you increased religious entities' rights, they were already starting from equality. Now they were going to have more rights than anybody else. That was the big mistake. But in this culture, it's hard to talk against rights. Rights holders are supposedly always right, and so it has taken quite a bit to find a way to talk about it and conclude that's not really such a great thing that they got those extra rights.
Hmm. The book basically is divided into two sections. In one, where you look at six areas, to quote as you write about it here, six areas where religious individuals and institutions have insisted on the right to avoid the law as they have harmed others, and they are children, marriage, schools, land use in neighborhoods, prisons and the military, and civil rights. You say that sometimes that was a good thing, but often it was not. And perhaps we could take a couple of these areas, and you could give an example, give a kind of a case study to show what it is that we are talking about, and maybe we just start with the first one and talk about the area of children.
Absolutely. The children, for me, is the primary issue here, and there are really three arenas where children have been at risk from religious entities. One is clergy abuse, which we know a lot more now than we did in 2000 or 2001, and in the clergy abuse context, what happens is you have the individual that a child is taught to trust the most in the world. They may even be the representative of God. And that individual has the capacity to use the cloak of religion to worm their way into this child's trust. And those who go after children tend to be nice guys because that helps them achieve their goals. They tend to help everybody around them. But sometimes those guys are not good for children, and what happens is we have horrific stories of child abuse. And let me just tell you just part of one story, because it's so shocking, I think it's worth reading the extended version in the book. But Jennifer Chapin was brought to me as an example because she's agreed to do a taped interview, which as part of a settlement with the Catholic Church in California, and the reason she wanted to do the taped interview is she wanted that tape to be used to teach archdiocese what they need to do and what they need to guard against. But what happened to her is that at the age of five, their local parish priest befriended the family, befriended her, enjoyed taking her out, but within a very short time, started to take her to a hotel almost every weekend on Saturdays. And while in the hotel, not only did he rape her, but he also ritualistically abused her. And that's a category that's hardly ever talked about, because the rape, he said, made her Satan, and therefore now she had to be raped by a scepter, a religious scepter. So that's the kind of horrific abuse that happened, not just in her case. It happened too often. But the problem with the law is that in that very case, when she sued and said, look at what you've done to me, please, let's have some justice here, the response from the church was, we are not producing any of the files that have anything to do with this particular priest, and we have a First Amendment right not to show anybody anything. And that is happening in cases around the country, not just the Catholics. This is a problem in many denominations. But the tendency is you see them waving the First Amendment and saying, you can't get me because I have the First Amendment and I don't have to show you anything in here, despite the harm that everybody knows has happened. So that's a classic example of the abuse of trust. She was abused for 5 years, which is not an unusual length of time, and it was devastating for her in more ways than one.
So how, I guess I'm not quite sure I understand how you would use the First Amendment to make an argument that you are exempt from producing, that somehow you would not be guilty of withholding evidence in a criminal case.
Well, their argument is that if the government comes in to see their records on employment, the government is interfering somehow with the relationship between the priest and the institution. And the general argument is that they have something that they call church autonomy. They're completely autonomous from the law whenever anything has to do with the priest, and therefore they don't have to show any employment records. Now, the courts have been very impatient with that since 2002. They're not interested in a First Amendment argument if, in fact, it looks like the religious institution really has done some horrible things. But there are still states where if you're dealing with a priest or you're dealing with a member of the clergy and the victim sues, in some states, the answer will be, we're sorry, but you can't do any discovery because we can't interfere with the church.
Another area that you deal with in this section, and this seems to me perhaps to become a little bit more problematic because it gets into the area of religious practice, and that is medical neglect. Say that you have a case where you have parents of a child, the child is ill, and for whatever reason the parents believe that the most effective way to deal with the illness of the child is to pray or to do laying on of hands or something like that, anything other than conventional medical treatment, and say the child dies. Here I would imagine that if you're arguing on the side of the parents and on the religious institution, you would say here truly this is a matter of their belief, their religious practice, and if we then intervened in that case and said, because you didn't take your child to the doctor, you did the wrong thing, and that you're guilty of neglect, then truly we are stepping into the area of belief and practice, and that's one of those areas that we're supposed to stay out of.
Well, that's exactly why I wrote this book, because that is precisely what I think every American, including me, until about 10 years ago, believed, that if you've got belief, that somehow the belief, when you're focusing on the belief, you lose focus on the harm. Mm-hmm. If a child dies because they have been medically neglected, a child dies of diabetes, for example, because they've never received treatment, it's an agonizing death, the result is that child died. And those parents were permitted to make a martyr of that child before the child had any ability to choose whether or not the child was going to choose laying on of hands or prayer over life. And that's the point of the book. We need to be a lot more hard-headed because we're not just weighing whether to leave religious entities alone to have their own beliefs in a kind of beautiful world against an evil government. We are weighing the lives of children over and against religious belief. And there are a number of circumstances where you have to go with the life of the child and not with the religious belief, as sincere as it is. And I think the government's job is to deter parents from letting their children die, even if it does force those parents into the hospitals.
And have there been cases where, generally speaking, the law has tended to favor parents in this particular kind of situation?
Well, in over 30 states, we have a circumstance where the laws create exemptions. And so if you medically neglected your child because you were out smoking cocaine and weren't doing the right things, you'd go to jail. But if you medically neglected your child because of your religious belief, you would be let off. So, for example, in Oregon, in the late 90s, there was a group that the local authorities found three children died within a very close period of time, three infants, and all of them could have lived had they received minimal medical treatment. And the prosecutors were beside themselves that three children, that this could happen to them in such a short period of time. They wanted to prosecute the parents who let these children die and could have saved them. It turned out they couldn't, because in Oregon, the law at that time gave the religious believer who believed in faith healing an exemption from even felony murder and from any kind of criminal liability.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Marcy Hamilton. She is an internationally known constitutional expert who specializes in church-state relations. She's a leading national authority on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, has been involved in some cutting-edge First Amendment litigation, both for clergy abuse and land use. She's professor of law at the Benjamin Cardozo Law School at Yeshiva University of New York City, and has spoken widely and written widely on this particular subject. And she is the author of a book. If you're interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book. It's titled God Versus the Gavel, Religion and the Rule of Law. It's published by the Cambridge University Press, so should be available in the bookstore. We have an Indiana caller here on the line, someone to talk with on our line number four. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. One, it's God's will. And we're sorry the little girl's raped, but God had a better picture of what's going on in the future, so that's the way it is. How does anyone deal with that in a court situation? And number two, if you know anything about it, how in the world these kind of laws get presented in state legislatures? I mean, I'm accustomed to industry lobbyists and stuff. Do we have fundamentalist lobbyists out there turning the pages for legislatures to make these kind of laws, or was there some general legal principle that in a sense got mishandled and ran away from its roots? Thanks.
Well, that's an excellent question, and actually 10 years ago my answer would have been don't refer to anybody who is religious as a lobbyist. But I can tell you now that religious lobbyists are extremely active in every state legislature and in Congress. They have been permitted to lobby and to ask for this special treatment under the law behind the scenes, because members of the various state legislatures and Congress, just it hasn't occurred to them to ask themselves, gee, is this a bad idea to create an exemption for this individual? They're going to not treat a child. Or is this a really good idea to have an exemption at the federal level across every law in the country? When in fact, some of these laws we actually like the laws against murder and the laws against rape. So what's happened is religious entities have been behind the scenes, very active, very effective. And the point of the book, actually, is to out them. I want the society to debate these issues and not let a decision about whether or not the law is going to let off religious groups. I don't want that decision behind closed doors. That needs to be in the sunshine. It needs to be debated. And the truth is hardly anybody knows about the exemptions, let alone what's really going on in the state legislatures.
Maybe we move on to talk a little bit about a different area. And again, I just as a way of sampling some of the sorts of examples in case studies, another area that you talk about is in the area of schools. I guess, and I'm not sure if daycare falls in this area as well, I'm interested to know, perhaps people also will be interested to know, that there are a lot of places, and this state is one of them, where daycare centers that are run by religious organizations are exempt from the regulations that cover other daycare centers if you're not a religious entity.
Yeah, one of the most shocking stories for me, at least, was when I learned that the Florida legislature found out that there were summer camps in which there was intense both physical and sexual abuse of children. And the question in the legislature was, what should they do to regulate these camps? And the final answer in the legislature, as a result of intense lobbying behind the scenes, was that they decided to completely deregulate them, to completely step out of the picture and leave those children at risk. And that is, for me, just a paradigm example of what's wrong with the way we're handling religion in this society. And there are plenty of states that do not regulate religious entities. And the argument is almost always the religious entity needs to use whatever funds it has for its mission and shouldn't be forced to do things like expensive fire protection systems. Mm-hmm. Or they shouldn't have to have accreditation of teachers, on and on and on. I'm tuned in to the argument that we've got too much regulation in a lot of areas, but complete deregulation where children are involved is a disaster.
Hmm. Another area that is a special interest of yours is in land use. Give us an example that comes out of that category.
Well, what's happened with land use is that Congress in 2000 and then President Clinton signed what's called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which if it sounds like sausage, it is, or LUPA we call it. And basically what it says is that local governments are constrained from applying their local zoning laws to landowners just because they're religious. And that law applies to every zoned district in any community. But what I found in my experiences with it, which is pretty extensive, is that it is causing tremendous heartache and problems in residential neighborhoods because churches that would have never requested, for example, in a residential neighborhood, never would have requested in Wyoming, could they have 100-child secular daycare in the church and then have an extra parking lot in order to put the everybody when the children are dropped off. That's the sort of project that you wouldn't expect in a residential neighborhood. A daycare center of that size would need to be in a different zoned area. And then we have arenas where full-scale synagogues and churches are being permitted to come into lots that are far too small and clearly impinge on the neighbors and change the character of the residential neighborhood. So for me, it's taken on kind of a mythic proportion because what our LUPA has done is literally threatened the American dream, the quiet residential neighborhood. And in my view, it's unconstitutional. It won't be here forever. But for the time being, religious entities are using it to get around land use laws that were intended to make everybody else get along.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Eureka, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting program. Everything is filled with paradoxes, but one often hears the drumbeat, almost the propagandistic use of we are martyrs, we are victims, the state is against us, yet some of these, and I guess one needs to be specific, like the camps you described in Florida or the horrible, horrible abuses of some of the Roman Catholic clergy, those that have been convicted and brought before a real court of law, they seem to know no bounds in terms of their living in a fantasy world. Because I was talking to a friend this morning that's a nurse, and if any of the clergy I have known, or a teacher or a nurse, were guilty of some of these child abuses, they would be thrown out of their job so fast and prosecuted. Their head would spin. Yet some of these groups seem to. They want to have it both ways, your comment.
Well, absolutely. And what I'm finding is because I'm heavily involved with helping clergy abuse victims around the country, both in some litigation but also in helping them in the state legislatures, just yesterday I heard someone, an evangelical representative, argue that Ohio should have no requirement for reporting child abuse for clergy. If a clergy person knows about child abuse, they shouldn't have to report it because it might ruin the career of the minister if there was a false accusation. Hmm. That's just the wrong balance.
Exactly.
It's outrageous.
And
but
yet,
it's typical.
It is, and it's like Jimmy Swigert or Baker, you know, they'll rant and rave about the sexual sins but yet as being the worst perverts, but yet when they themselves are caught, they're somehow exempted, or this whole issue of homosexuality. There is no one that rants and raves more about the sin of homosexuality than some of these same group, but yet when caught by themselves, somehow they're above it all. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Let's go to Danville next, line number 1. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Excellent conversation here. I guess the question that I have, are we seeing the rise in all of this? Because not only, of course, the abuse and exemptions and so forth that churches have, but also just the political power and club that is being developed over the last few years here. Are we seeing the rise in what could be described as the American Taliban?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it that, but I sure would call it a theocracy. There is a every human is tempted to abuse their power. In fact, our Constitution is based on that important insight, and religious institutions are no less susceptible. And with the political power that various religious institutions are now wielding, the temptation to abuse that power is huge. But what's so fascinating is at the time when we are at the apex, just an enormous amount of plainly visible political power, we hear arguments that they are discriminated against and that this is a secular society. That's just not true. Secular in what sense? The number of atheists is tiny. Almost everybody is a believer in the United States. We have the highest church attendance of any country in the world. And we've got lots of religion going on, but it's at this point it's exercising a tremendous amount of political power. But what political power does, as we all know, is it tempts people to go over their bounds. And I think we have seen some of that recently.
Well, and we've also seen them really go after people with a vengeance, too. I mean, just to actually destroy them politically, economically, et cetera. The other thing, too, I don't know, I'm sure plays into this a lot, but you know, over the last several years, we've also had this huge interest in Revelation and the Left Behind series and so forth. It's gained great popularity. And I'll just ask this last question. In this, I'll hang up and listen to your comment, but in this, what we're seeing is a vast number of people who are practicing predestination, and I don't have to be responsible for anything I do because I'm not going to be here to suffer the consequences.
Well, what's so fascinating about this movement is that it echoes movements that were around at the time of the framing of the Constitution. And when the United States started, there was a sense that we were a noble people. We were above the crass Europeans. Even the Europeans believed that for a while. And then it turned out that over here there was more licentiousness than anybody had imagined, and there were arguments that licentiousness was forgiven because either the world was going to end or there was always forgiveness. That is a convenient way to be unaccountable, but in a Republican form of democracy like we have, no one has the right to be unaccountable, regardless of their beliefs.
You touch on something, and it seems that's something that I feel that I have heard increasingly in recent years, and that is the complaint from some people that they feel that people of faith are actually, and not only are they simply being discriminated against, not allowed the free expression of their religion, but people actually do use the word persecuted. And talking not just about other countries, but talking about the United States, and they tend, it seems that they tend to be conservative Christians who are saying this, that they think that somehow Christians here in the United States today are being persecuted.
Well, what's so interesting about that claim is that they have never had more access to the public square. Their voices are loud, they're on TV, they're on the radio, they're politically effective. And so to argue that this is a group that's being persecuted just as a factual matter is a little troubling. But what's really going on is that when anyone holds tremendous amounts of political power, it's much more convenient to argue that you really don't have much power because there's going to be less force against you. And I think that these arguments that there's persecution really arises from their being upset about the growth of the Establishment Clause, which requires the separation of church and state in the public schools. They're upset about the public schools being so-called secularized, but in truth, in the public square, they have never been more powerful, and so there's great irony there.
Let's talk with someone in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Oh, yes. I think you're applying a double standard when you talk about the abuse cases. I know there's quite a bit of abuse in the public school system, and for instance, you're from New York, and I understand that in New York City alone, they were forced to actually reinstate teachers who had committed sex abuse under a teacher's union contract. And so you have this problem which is pervasive through all society, and to kind of use it as a way of attacking religion, I think, is, to be unfair in that sense.
Well, but be careful. My argument is not that those teachers ever should have been put back in the schools in New York. That's outrageous. My argument is that the rule has always been that if a teacher abuses a child, that teacher should get into trouble. We've never questioned that rule. That's just, we've expected that to happen. But we have questioned it if it was a religious teacher or if it was a religious clergy person. My argument is you better regulate in the interest of the children with respect to those secular public school teachers, but at the same time, we need to regulate the teachers and the clergy that also have the capacity to hurt children. So, excuse me, it's not a double standard. It's the same standard for everybody.
Well, I think, though, it's more of a problem that pervades society as a whole rather than a problem of religious institutions. And I think, basically, it's actually a lack of religious values in society that causes that problem. And, you know, it gets back to the point where you always hear people saying that religious people are trying to impose their values on society. But actually, if you look at the legal history recently, it's actually courts that are really pushing the envelope, so to speak, with the homosexual rights and with other issues such as prayer. And it's really the ACLU and the courts that are really pushing this agenda. And it's basically a reaction. If there's anything on the religious part, it's a reaction against what's going on in the courts and in the actually in the public school systems too.
Well, statistically, there are just as many crimes within religious organizations against children as there are in the secular institutions. So any argument that the religious groups should be treated differently when there's harm that occurs just doesn't wash.
Well, I think they're treated worse. I think they're treated more. I don't think they're treated differently. I think if you look at the publicity against the Catholic Church in the last few years, they actually get worse treatment than the public school system. And actually, there's far more cases in the public school system than in the. But nobody's, attacking the public schools the way that they're attacking the Catholic Church.
Well, I mean, I could tell you, with respect to New York, it was the headline every day regarding the abuse of children by these teachers in the public school system. I completely disagree about any notion that there's any kind of persecution of religious entities. The problem for the Roman Catholic Church is not just that individuals were engaged in child abuse, which is bad enough, but the institution permitted it, knew about it, and knew that it was being repeated over and over. The institutional protection of child abuse is the problem, and that's why it's gotten a fair amount of press, but as someone who deals with victims almost every day, the press coverage has not nearly been as hard-hitting as it ought to be.
Well, my only point is that it's a double standard because while the church has done things to remove people from albeit late, there was problems with the church. I agree to that, but now they have taken steps, and perhaps it's not completed yet. But you still see something like in New York City, where the public schools were actually forced to reinstate teachers who had committed sexual abuse by union contracts. And I'm just saying it's a pervasive societal problem that I think the attention that was focused on the Catholic Church was not focused on this case. You didn't hear national headlines about this as much as you did against the Catholic Church in recent years.
Well, I mean, once again, I my view is that it's across-the-board treatment. If someone harms a child, I don't care who they are, they should be held accountable. And the fact they are religious should not get them out from under that accountability when the harm is that severe. And what my book is explaining is that the law has, in fact, treated religious entities better, made it easier for them to avoid accountability than secular entities. So in reality, unfortunately, religious entities have gotten better treatment. And to tell you the truth, 10 years ago, I would have been saying what you're saying very loudly, but I've been educated by those who've been harmed by religious entities to such a degree that equal treatment across the board is the only thing that's going to work.
I need to jump in here, but coming into our last 15 minutes, I have another caller I want to get to, and I want to invite others to, if you'd like to join the conversation. We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Marcy Hamilton. She is one of the nation's leading constitutional law scholars who publishes and lectures frequently on the topic, and in particular, area of interest of hers is the relationship between church and state. She's professor of law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law of Yeshiva University Residency in New York City. She's also been visiting scholar at the Princeton Theological Seminary and visiting professor of law at New York University School of Law and Emory University School of Law. It is frequently asked to advise Congress and state legislatures on the constitutionality of pending legislation. She's author of a book that touches on the subject, not just touches on it, but covers it in depth. And if you're interested in reading more, you should look for the book. It's titled God Versus the Gavel, Religion and the Rule of Law, and it's published by the Cambridge University Press. We'll come back here to Urbana for another caller next, and that's line number one. Hello.
Yeah, it's so good to hear somebody arguing your point of view. It's seems so lacking, and yet it seems so basic, you know? Weren't a lot of these aren't the arguments you're making basic, very very basic to this entire government? I mean, we present evidence at trials. We don't merely look to beliefs. It seemed very clear that they wanted the founders wanted a rule of law created by men. And not taken, lifted from sacred texts. And I'm just wondering, why is it that people trained in law, anybody trained in law, could possibly be won over to the idea that they should be giving religions some sort of path? I'd like to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, the problem in our society has been not facing up to what religious entities have actually been doing. It's not citizens' fault. In part, it's because legislators have been willing to give special treatment for religious entities without anybody finding out, and then the harm follows, but it's hard for citizens to understand. With respect to legal academics and lawyers in general, you don't look for religious entities breaking the law. I think it was Andy Rooney who said, you know, nobody wants to hear anything negative about religion, so they don't even report it. That's the truth. We don't want to hear anything negative about religion, because if you take religion away from a lot of people, you've taken what is their anchor in life. The problem is that religion involves humans, and humans are fallible, and they have to be held accountable. And this is James Madison's vision of the United States, that we would have religious entities that would have every right to believe whatever they wanted, but they had to be accountable for their conduct. That's been the rule of the Supreme Court since the late 19th century, except for a very short period of time when Justice Brennan's test was used, which gave religious entities more power. But anybody who starts to examine the facts, and that's why I have the six chapters in my book detailing case after case after case of harm. Once you know the facts, it's ineluctable. You have to conclude, of course, we have to apply the rule of law.
Well, if legislatures are passing laws somehow exempting religious organizations from the same kinds of laws and regulations that anybody else has to abide by, do you think that it is because those legislators favor those religious bodies, or that they are afraid of opening themselves up to the charge that they are somehow anti-religion?
Oh, I think that's a big chunk of it. In this society, to be opposed to religion as a politician is very dangerous. But the mistake politicians are making is they're assuming that if they don't do something that this particular religious lobbyist asked, that all the members of that religion are now going to turn against that politician. But it's been my experience that there's a vast silent majority that believes that it's crazy to give religious entities a tremendous amount of power to break laws. It's just, it doesn't make any sense in the American context, and politicians need to stand up for what's right. The big problem here for me is the legislators, the members of Congress, who could pass a law like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that gave religious entities an out from every law in the country. And do you know, in 3 years of hearings, no one once asked, gee, could this harm children, or would this be a bad thing for residential homeowners? They didn't ask any of those questions. They spent the 3 years actually talking about how they knew a lot more about religious liberty than the Supreme Court. So the problem in our society is we're too prone to look at the rights holder, and we forget that sometimes if you increase those rights, it's a zero-sum game and you're going to hurt someone else.
Mm-hmm. It seems that over the last couple of decades, at least, we have been talking a lot about the First Amendment and what it says about religion and what that means. And it seems that it's something that we're not quite sure about. We really don't quite understand. And, you know, perhaps people have on and off since it was written, people have been having this argument, but it seems we're in a period where it's particularly intense. It seems that and maybe what people are choosing to do is to err on one side and not the other. So saying if we're really not quite sure what it means either to allow people to express their religious faith or to infringe on that, we're going to lean over to one side and we're going to say, well, we don't want to do anything that makes it look in any way that we're doing anything to infringe on people's exercise of their religious beliefs.
Oh, I think that's right. And the reason for that is this concept of the sacred quality of religious belief and conduct and how rights are more important than the government interest. But if you compare the right to avoid discovery in a clergy abuse case with the interest of the government in getting out to the public exactly how these children have been treated, the interest of the government is very heavy. But it has, for at least since 1963, it has been a minority voice that's been arguing what I'm arguing. It is that let's hold everybody up to a standard of accountability. But we're coming around. The more we learn about religious entities hurting other people, and I think the Roman Catholic Church's problems have been a trigger for thinking more carefully about these issues. I think the tendency to say, well, maybe we should just give them the benefit of the doubt is going to come into question, and maybe we'll get some legislators that will say, when they're asked to provide an exemption, they'll say, well, but who's going to get hurt if I let you have this exemption? That's the question they should have been asking all along. Let's hope they start asking it.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular cases, any particular cases, though, you can cite where you think, where you actually would support an exemption, say, a particular case where there was a law that we would say, yes, it's appropriate that this applies to everybody else. However, in this particular case, with this religious organization, in its exercise of its beliefs, we would say, actually, we would support in that case an exemption.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are a number of exemptions that don't harm anybody. A great example is the exemption that many states and also the federal government has for the Native American Church that permits them to use what is illegal peyote. It's an illegal drug, but they're permitted to use it in their worship services. Now, peyote is a really crummy drug, as I'm told. It gives you headaches. Sometimes it doesn't work. It gives you a stomach ache. It's not the kind of drug that's going to be used recreationally. So giving them an exemption solely for the purpose of their worship service, that doesn't hurt anybody. But the heroin church in Los Angeles, they should not be getting an exemption. And it's up to our legislators to weigh the public good and the public interest against what can we do for religious liberty. And that's where we ought to be.
Hmm. And is that always such an easy thing to do?
No, I think, but legislators every single day have hard choices.
Hmm.
But we give them the power to make the hard choices. We delegate our authority to them. They're supposed to be making the hard choices. What they're not supposed to do is to fail to ask the question about the public good. If they don't ask the public good question too often, the result in this arena is that people get hurt.
And I think your argument is that what legislators have done is they have abdicated their responsibility, and they have, in a sense, dumped it in the lap of the judiciary and said, well, you know, we really don't want to deal with this. This is too hot. Let somebody else
Precisely.
Make the decision. Yeah. Well, where do you think that we're headed now with this? And whether there are, do you think that there will be more people who would at least want to give someone like you who makes this kind of argument a fair hearing?
Well, the United States always works on a pendulum. I think we are at the very top of the swing of the pendulum, arguing for expansive religious liberty without considering the consequences. I do find that as I've been talking to people that there is real eagerness to try to come to articulate what it is that's been missing from the debate for about 20 years. And what's been missing is this concept that even religious entities, even religious believers, they're not isolationists. They're not non-Americans. They're Americans, and therefore in the system, they're subject to the law, too. That is being, I'm trying to reintroduce that. I've been reintroducing it through my litigation. I think that the American people are ready for it and looking for it, because the abuses of power by religious entities in our era are getting clearer and clearer. And the more that happens, Americans, they recoil from that. Hmm.
We have another caller here, someone listening in Kankakee on our line 4. Hello.
Morning.
Mm-hmm.
Do not many of the problems which you discuss have their roots in an old and well-established principle in law, which might go by the name of privilege of clergy, which was well-established in the English common law, and that along with the First Amendment and a adjustment of contemporary American society to deviation now from successful application of church courts, of course, the First Amendment contribute to this. Thank you.
Well, actually, in Chapter 9, I lay out the historical development of that very issue, starting from the benefit of the clergy, which actually was started in the 12th century in the dispute between Henry II and Thomas Becket. But what the history shows you is we started by saying in England that clergy were above everybody else. So if you had a clergy person who raped someone, they might get a year at a monastery. Whereas if you weren't a member of the clergy, you were just someone, a commoner, and you raped someone, you'd be put to death almost immediately. That's how different the treatment was. And the clergy had that preferred treatment over a number of centuries. But as the common law and the concept of the rule of law evolved in Britain, by about the 17th century, it was simply indefensible that just because someone was religious, they didn't have to do the time for serious crimes. And so the result is that by the time people are migrating over to the early American colonies, the concept that religious entities are unaccountable under the law was no longer strong. Now, it has lived on in religious institutions. Certainly, the Catholic Church, our oldest Christian institution, continues to operate from that worldview in a lot of ways. But it is no longer the law, and in the United States, it's never been the law that religious entities, just because they were religious, or clergy, just because they were clergy, wouldn't have to abide by the law. And as I said earlier, since the end of the 19th century, it's been very clear if a religious person breaks the law, unless the legislature said they get an exemption, they have to obey it.
I think at that we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. I want to mention once again that if people who are listening this morning up in the Chicago area would be interested in hearing more from our guest, she'll be giving a talk at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore. That's at 5757 South University Avenue in Chicago. That's tonight at 7 o'clock. And for anybody else, if you're interested in reading more on the subject, you should look for the book that we mentioned. It's titled God Versus the Gavel. It's published by the Cambridge University Press by our guest, Marcy Hamilton. She's professor of law at the Benjamin Cardoso School of Law in New York City. Professor Hamilton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 interview first broadcast earlier this year. It comes from the Focus Archives. If you'd like to hear some past programs you might have missed or listen to interviews from the Afternoon Magazine or any other of our local production, you can go to that website anytime that you like. It's will.uiuc.edu. We hope that you will enjoy the rest of your day. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 4 minutes before 12 noon, and this is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, and we're about to kick off the afternoon magazine for this Friday midday. In for Celeste Quinn, I'm Tom Rogers. We will have the usual mix of news from the BBC, NPR, and AM 580 in the first half hour of our show. At 12:40 this afternoon, you'll get a chance to talk to meteorologist Ed Kieser about your weekend plans, see how the rather oppressive heat in the forecast for this weekend may affect your plans here or elsewhere, wherever you may want to travel. And then at 1 o'clock, an interview from the archive that Celeste did a couple of months ago on the subject of Betty Crocker. Probably one of the most recognized names in business, in the food industry, yet Betty Crocker is not a real person. We'll talk about how the name Betty Crocker came to be and what it means in terms of American housewives and kitchens across the country and the business of food in general. Let's take a look now at how the prices are faring on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange at this hour. The September wheat contract is currently at 327.5. That's up a half a penny. But the December wheat is down 341.25, down 1.25 cents. In fact, much of the board right now losing a little bit after gaining earlier in the day, after coming back from a big sell-off earlier this week. September corn right now is trading at 232.25. That's down 1.75 cents. December corn at 243.5, down 1.25. March is at 250.5, down 1 penny. And the May corn contract is at 254.5, also down 1 cent. Soybeans for August are at 666.5, now up to 667, down 2.5 cents. September beans are at 671, down 3.5 cents a bushel. And November soybeans are at 677, down 2.5. Soy products include August soy meal at 212.20, that's down 40, and soy oil for August is at 24.37, up 6. On the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, August feeder cattle are currently at 107.90, that's up 2.5. Live cattle for August at 79.60, up 47.5. August lean hogs at 68.15, down 7.5. And August pork bellies are at 71.02.5, and that's up 2 even. Looking outside the Chicago commodity trade, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is at 10,589. That's down 39 points now. The S&P 500 index is down about a half point at 1227. And the NASDAQ is down 11.5 points, currently at 2167.22. Crude oil for September is at 56.17. That's up 104 a barrel. The CRB index is at 303.59, up 283. And the U.S. dollar index is at 69.59. Check that, 89.59. That's up 86 cents.